you'd be relieved to know I'm not going to be bombarding you with a lot of information this evening. I have given talks in the past which were, you know, relatively dense, and this evening is not intended to be like that. So what I have in mind is that we're going to collectively look at symbols in a more general way. What are the characteristics of symbols? And later on I'm going to be asking you, ideally, to come up with ideas on that. So I'm going to give a bit of an introduction. Then we can look at some of my holiday snaps. Now, don't panic, it's not going to be me on the beach. But some photographs I've taken in Sri Lanka and Myanmar, which hopefully are relevant to this subject. And it's not any kind of travel log or anything. I want those pictures to wash over you. And while you're watching them, just think a bit about symbols. What are symbols? What are the characteristics of symbols? And then we can have a bit of a discussion. Now, I have a stock list with me on the characteristics of symbols. And it might be interesting to compare that with what you come up with. It's from an unlikely source, for a talk at a Buddhist centre. It's a list of characteristics of symbols that a theologian, Paul Tillich, some of you may have heard of him, came up with. He was born in Germany in 1886, and he was a theologian in Germany. He lost his post at the University of Frankfurt in 1933 when Hitler came to power and Nazism was on the rise. And he went to the USA and held several theology posts in various institutions, including Harvard, University of Chicago. And he died in 1965. And I have one of his books here, which has, I think, a very good, very accessible chapter on symbols. This is Dynamics of Faith. Some of his material is quite obscure, actually, I find. But the chapter on symbols, I think, is very good. So we have that to fall back on, but I will be asking you preferably to come up with ideas. Okay, so to set the scene, as it were, you can think of knowledge or understanding, insight, at three different levels. And this is like a hierarchy. So the first I'm going to mention is not as good as the second, which is not as good as the third. Okay? And the first is understanding from what we have merely heard. So the Sanskrit term is shrutamayi pranya, which means wisdom that we have merely heard. And nowadays, of course, we read a lot of things, but in the Buddha's day, his teachings were an oral tradition, probably for at least a couple of hundred years before his teaching was put down in a written form. So this is a kind of knowledge, a kind of insight that we're taking on trust. We're taking it on the word of another person. And the second level of understanding, which is thought to be better, is the kind of understanding we work out for ourselves. We can apply our analytical thinking, we can reflect on things. And I can tell you, over the time that I have spent as a Buddhist, I have spent a lot of time just thinking about Buddhist teachings, trying to sort them out, trying to understand them. And I think that is very important, actually. I think sometimes we underestimate, we undervalue the intellect, if you like, in practicing as a Buddhist. But this second level of understanding, the Sanskrit word is chintamayi pranya. So this is pranya, or wisdom, based on thinking. So that is more highly regarded than shrutamayi pranya. And I think that is quite a general thing in Buddhism, that we don't take things on trust. We don't have, for instance, an idea of faith as a passive belief in some kind of received or revealed dogma in Buddhism. What is more highly regarded is something that we have tested for ourselves. And very often in this context, the Kalama Sutta is quoted. And some of you might want to look this up for yourselves. There's a very good website access to insight. And I've actually just printed off some of the sutta here. And it tells the story of the Buddha being visited by the Kalamas of Kesaputta. So the Kalamas came along to the Buddha and they said, we have various Brahmins, we have various Shramanas. Shramanas are wandering renunciants, teachers. So we have these various teachers coming along, and this translation of the sutta says, they expound and glorify their own doctrines. But as for the doctrines of others, they deprecate them, revile them, show contempt for them, and disparage them. So the Kalamas were asking the Buddha, which of these venerable Brahmins and contemplatives are speaking the truth, and which ones are lying? They wanted to know which teaching to put their trust in, which teachings to follow, because they were being exposed to all these different ones. And the Buddha replied, of course you are uncertain, Kalamas. Of course you are in doubt. When there are reasons for doubt, uncertainty is born. So in this case, Kalamas, don't go by reports, by legends, by traditions, by scripture, by logical conjecture, by inference, by analogies, by agreement through pondering views, by probability, or by the thought, this contemplative is our teacher. And the Buddha went on to say, when you know for yourselves that these qualities are unskillful, these qualities are blameworthy, these qualities are criticized by the wise, these qualities, when adopted and carried out, lead to harm and to suffering, then you should abandon them. So what he's saying is, you test things with your own experience. You apply your own experience, and you also have the check of what wise people say. So there is this empirical or testing theme, which I think is very widespread in Buddhism, that we don't just take things on trust. So that is why chintamayi pranya is more valued than shrutamayi pranya. But the kind of wisdom that is most valued is bhavana pranya, bhavana mayi pranya. And bhavana, as many of you will know, means causing to become or development. And of course, we have a meditation practice, metta bhavana. And there, bhavana means cultivation. So we're talking about the cultivation or development of metta. And this kind of wisdom is generally experienced in meditation. And it's a kind of wisdom that goes to the very depths of your being. It infiltrates your being, and it's very likely to affect your thoughts and your action. And this is the kind of wisdom that the Buddha experienced in enlightenment. This was his enlightenment experience. So this is a very profound kind of wisdom. But it's very difficult to convey to other people. Indeed, you could say from a certain point of view that you can't really talk about it. You could say that it's indescribable. You could say it's ineffable. You could say it transcends rational thought. You could say it transcends the intellect and the vehicles of the intellect, words. And we're told that the Buddha agonized for a long time as to whether he could really teach what he had come across, this very profound wisdom. And eventually he was prevailed upon by Brahma Sahampati, according to tradition. And thankfully, he went on to teach for 45 years. He tramped around northeast India, teaching and doing his best, which was pretty good, to try and express and convey this enlightenment experience. But in the end of the day, it can be very difficult to express. Now, Ratnaprabha actually reminded me of a chapter in The Three Jewels by Sangharachita, in which he categorizes ways of trying to talk about enlightenment or express enlightenment. One is in negative terms, one is in positive terms, one is in paradoxical terms, and one is in symbols. And to take the first two to start with, it's probably easier to say what enlightenment isn't than what it is. So if we talk about trying to express it in negative terms, what usually happens is that we think of some unhealthy mental state and we say that nirvana or enlightenment is the eradication of that. So you might say it's the eradication of the poisons or the ashravas or the kleshas. And there's a quite a nice little quote here that the wanderer who ate rose apples asked Shariputra, and many of you will know that Shariputra was one of the main disciples of the Buddha. So the wanderer who ate rose apples asked Shariputra what nirvana was. And the great disciple replied, "Whatever is the extinction of passion, of aversion, of confusion, this is called nirvana." So he was trying to convey it in negative terms. Generally less successful is to try and describe it in positive terms. And here we normally take some kind of attribute, some kind of desirable quality, and we express it in the superlative. So we might talk about supreme bliss or great compassion. Okay, everybody with it so far? The other way is in paradoxical terms, and that would be a method used par excellence in the Prajnaparamita teachings of, say, Nagarjuna. And that is a very good way of trying to convey the mystery and the ineffability, if you like, of enlightenment. And just to take a very short example, you might say that nirvana should be attained by means of a non-attainment. So there we have an example of a paradox. Also using koans in the Rinzai Zen Buddhist tradition would again be using paradox. But the last method, and arguably the best method, is to use symbols. And that's what we're going to be focusing a bit on. So maybe then if we could have the holiday snaps, and just if you just let it wash over you, there are a couple that I've put in just to keep you on your toes. So... you've had this course looking at various symbols, but what I'm hoping we can do now is just think more generally about what are symbols, what do, what are their characteristics. I don't want to say too much because I'd like to see what comes up. I do have telex material, but be very interesting. Has anybody got any suggestions? It doesn't have to be an all-encompassing definition of symbols, just a characteristic of symbols.
Something that's close to something else.
Brilliant. Brilliant. Yeah, I think that is very central. Now we can come back to that, but does anybody else have any thoughts?
They convey their message in a more direct way.
Yeah. Can you say anything more about that?
Compare it to verbal communication, but then of course words can also be symbols, so I'm not sure if that works. It simplifies the message, doesn't it? I mean, because doing picture exchange communication stuff, the series that follows, as interesting, said three things is visually what you can, the easiest thing to understand is a photograph, then there's a drawing, and then finally is a symbol. Not everybody can understand that abstraction.
So, does it avoid the abstraction? Or?
Well, depends what kind of mind you've got. But
at any rate, it simplifies the message. And does this follow from that? Does it convey the message more directly?
It sounds like you're suggesting it's less directly.
It
so,
is, yes.
So, for example, a toilet, you could have a photograph of somebody going to the loo, couldn't you? Or you could have a sketch. Or you could have the emblem on the door.
Yeah.
And so the photograph would be the one that worked best, and the emblem on the door would be the one that needed most interpretation.
Okay.
Yes, your mind is to, depends on how your mind works. People with learning difficulty do that,
Yeah.
But sometimes I guess it might be. I didn't really mean to look around like that.
Yeah. But some symbols are quite complex though, aren't they?
Mm.
Like if you take the stupa, there are lots of different layers of meaning in it.
I was going to say it deepens the message as well.
Mm-hmm.
Especially the symbols like that, complex ones.
I think sometimes we use the word symbol and sign sort of rather interchangeably, don't you? So if you see on the road, if you see a sign for a low bridge, in a way it's just a very, very stylized sense of a low bridge, isn't it? But it doesn't have the symbolic richness of the image of a Buddha representing enlightenment, does it? It seems to me. So maybe we're talking more about those very rich symbols rather than the signs for the toilet or for the low bridge or whatever.
I do think when you say symbols like logos and
these, that's what one thinks of that as well, because that's part of the use of the word symbol, isn't
it? Yeah. Well, I'm going to come to that actually, but that is one of the things. What is the difference between a symbol and a sign? I can talk about that in a few minutes. Any other suggestions?
An effective symbol clarifies.
Sorry?
An effective symbol clarifies. Mm-hmm.
Go on. Can you say any more about that?
Sometimes it helps. It brings insight.
I think also a symbol usually stands for something more than just a simple sign. You get the message, and that's the end of the story. Whereas a symbol is telling you more. It's got a connection with what it's saying. But it is something in itself too.
So it's telling you. How did you put it? You put it very well.
More than a simple sign.
Telling you more than than a sign.
Yeah.
Good.
It kind of evokes qualities.
Can you give examples?
I was thinking of that story of the Buddha holding up a flower, instead of giving a teaching at one point, Buddha was holding up a flower, and then I think one of the people in gained enlightenment just was that gesture and just the flower.
Well, I think this is really good. Maybe it's time to look a bit at what Tillich says. No, there are other... Sorry.
So I was just wondering, can a symbol be something other than visual?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, like a mudra. Yes, it could be a sign, like a mantra. A mantra, I think you could regard as a symbol.
Or it could be the scent of incense.
Could be the scent of incense.
Any sense.
I think any sense, yeah.
Yeah. It's meant to have connotations, isn't it, a symbol? A symbol is meant to make you think of other things, isn't it? Or identify
with other things. Yeah. Okay, well, a sign does this. To give an example, a red traffic light means we have to stop. So that sign of a red traffic light is pointing to something else. It's pointing to the command to stop. But a symbol also stands for something else. But a sign, the connection between, there isn't really any essential connection between a red light and stopping. It's by convention. We have this convention in this country and many other countries that when we're driving and we see a red traffic light, we should stop. And a lot of signs are like this. Letters, musical notation indicate certain notes. Mathematical symbols. So those are signs. Now, what Tillich says, and he says that where a symbol differs from a sign is it participates in whatever it's pointing to. So to take an example, if you took a flag of a country he argues that that participates in the majesty, the power of the country. And we know that people do get very, very attached to flags. And it's as if their flag is disrespected, then their country is not being shown disrespect, and it's akin to blasphemy. And I can tell a story, actually, that I came across this Kurdish man who had been wearing a Kurdish flag on his T-shirt, and he went to an accident, an emergency department, and rightly or wrongly, he inferred that the doctor in the department was not showing due respect to the flag on his T-shirt. Because the doctor asked him what it was, and this Kurdish man sort of inferred that it was not being shown due respect. And he went home, got various weapons, returned to the accident and emergency department with the intention of doing serious harm to that doctor. Luckily, someone intervened and prevented serious injury happening. But I think that illustrates Tillich's point that a symbol participates in whatever it is pointing to. So it's like a sign in this respect, but it participates in what it's pointing to. Now some of you were touching on this one. He also says that symbols open up or disclose or reveal aspects of reality that would otherwise not be revealed to us. And I think, you know, some people were coming up with that kind of suggestion. So you could argue that a stupa, for instance, if we use it in the six element practice, could reveal aspects of reality that would otherwise not be available to us. But it isn't just aspects of reality, it's dimensions of ourselves are revealed by symbols. And we all know that sometimes you can look at a great painting or listen to a particular piece of music, or you go and watch a play and you think, ah, I'm like that. Or you come away with a feeling that you know more about yourself. I think all of you have had that experience. You come away with a greater insight, greater knowledge of yourselves. You know, great art, I think, is potentially enriching in that way, not only in disclosing levels of reality, but things about ourselves. He goes on to say that symbols cannot be produced intentionally. We cannot just invent symbols, unlike signs. And here he relies on Jungian analytical theory, and he says that symbols arise from our individual or collective unconscious. So it follows from that, you know, symbols just can't just be replaced. They can't be invented. And he says, like living beings, they grow and they die. So they arise, if you like, from our unconscious, our individual or collective unconscious. But they can die. Now, have any of you... Yeah, you know, Have any of you... one suggestion would be that there is a lot of scepticism around rebirth, the doctrine of rebirth, in the West particularly. And possibly more scepticism in the Far East, in traditional Buddhist countries, than there used to be. And it's a suggestion which I don't necessarily ascribe to, but it's a suggestion that the resonance of that, of the symbolic quality of rebirth doctrine, is being lost to some extent, and that symbol is withering. But that's only one theory, and I'm not sure that I necessarily ascribe to that. But some people would put that kind of idea.
So is it possible to say this symbolizes that? So if somebody says this is a symbol, can one always say what it symbolizes? Yes.
Well, yeah. Well, why shouldn't we? I mean, traditionally the stupa sort of symbolizes six elements. So why shouldn't we say that? Hmm. But those six elements are tied up with reality and aspects of ourselves.
But maybe not in a simple way. You know, it might symbolize different things at different times, different people, a bit like dreams do. I mean, if you think dreams are symbolic, but you know, different things in dreams can mean different things, not always the same. Science always means the same, doesn't it? It's like one-to-one correspondence. Yeah. Symbols are. Yeah.
So some books will say if you see a dog in a dream, it means such and such.
Yeah.
Exactly. But that seems very oversimplified, doesn't it?
Exactly, it's sort of reductive. Yeah. Symbols are not reductive, although they're the opposite.
No.
A certain cultural element, because I can get more out of, say, pictures of religious art where I kind of know a bit about the stories and whatever, whereas the sort of Buddhist art is, I find I struggle a bit more with, because I don't really know the stories so well. So I think it helps if you've got the kind of symbols can catch you. Sometimes they catch you without that, but I think it helps if you've got a context.
Mm. I just wanted to touch a bit on myth and myth can be regarded just as symbols strung together, collected together in a story, and what really took me to reading a bit of Tillich is that someone mentioned his concept of broken myths, which I think is a very useful concept. And he talks about two kinds of literalism, natural and reactive literalism. Now, I don't know, did any of you see a recent film called Embrace of the Serpent?
Yeah.
Right. About, do you want to say briefly what it's about?
It's about a Colombian shaman who is visited twice in his life by two different Western explorers, and when he's younger they're both searching for a flower called the Kiruna flower, but when he's younger he's more resistant to the idea of sharing his knowledge with the West. When he's older he recognises that perhaps that's what he has to do.
But the relevance of why I'm mentioning this, he has certain beliefs which we might regard as myths, but he takes quite literally. So this is a kind of natural literalism, that myths are just taken literally in a natural way. I suppose you could say that about the doctrine of rebirth in some traditional Buddhist countries. It's just taken quite naturally, a natural literalism. But when people start to question that, then there are two choices. You can either make it a broken myth, and then you realize you accept it's a myth. You don't take it literally, but you accept it as a myth, and it retains, you know, great potential transformative qualities. It, in Tillich's term, would retain a connection with the ultimate. Or you can react against that. You can suppress the questioning mind, and you can fall back on a sort of reactive literalism. And then the risk is that you lose the connection with the ultimate. And an example might be, say, the story of the fall of Adam, where you believe that there was a particular person in a particular garden, in a particular geographical location, who ate an apple and so on. Now, he would argue that that would be a form of reactive literalism, which runs the risk of losing the connection with the whatever is of ultimate concern to you. Because he talks about faith, and he says that faith is what is of ultimate concern to us. The term faith is fraught with problems in Buddhism, because we don't have that idea of just a passive belief. But anyway, we can just say religion, or we can say Buddhism instead. Religion or Buddhism is what is of ultimate concern to us. And anyway, he argues that with reactive literalism, then we can run the risk of losing that connection with what is of ultimate concern to us. Understanding
the symbol.
Symbols.
Like you say, we run the danger of being stuck in the symbol literally, but also the meaning of the symbol sometimes is given by other people.
I'm a little bit stuck here. It's when you really question a myth with natural literalism, you just accept it. It's literally true. And when you start to question it, then there is that choice of either having what's called a broken myth, which has transformative qualities and a connection with the ultimate.
I understand that, but
you understand?
Sometimes people give different descriptions or different meanings to
yeah.
the same symbol.
Yeah. I don't think there's a problem with that. If it's meaningful for a person and is positive for them and transformative for them. I mean, a lot of these symbols can indicate different things. In the meditation session, I mentioned what many people take as symbolic of a candle flame, or burning incense, or flowers, but that isn't universal.
These are some symbols that are more open to different interpretations.
Yeah, I think it was the point that was made here, really. Yeah, yeah. So, what we've done is we've talked about the kind of understanding or insight that the Buddha had, and we've said that that is very difficult to convey, and I'm putting it to you that one of the best ways, and possibly the best way, is using symbols. In fact, Tillich believes it was the only way to express what was of ultimate concern. We've talked about what might be some of the characteristics of symbols in, for instance, distinguishing from signs. But there are other things one can read on symbols which I just haven't had a chance to do for this evening. I mean, Jung, for instance, wrote a lot on symbols and archetypes. So, unless there are any other questions, I think we can leave it. I mean, we're a bit early.
Any other thoughts or questions?
Well, I just have one. Your points that you made, 3, 4, 5, 6, I hadn't sort of categorised it in that way, but I when I look at a symbol, I feel as if I get it's like a transmission, for example, being in the shrine room. So actually all those things actually happen. And when I'd number 5, if I feel, I remember I discussed it with somebody before, but if something is actually fixed, then actually there potentially is a problem if something is just like a fixed situation. But actually if it changes and morphs naturally,
mm-hmm.
then it's actually a positive,
mm-hmm.
And it reflects what's happening for me.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's something that's maybe been brought out in this discussion that I hadn't really thought enough about. There is that maybe fluidity and versatility in how one can use symbols. Yeah.
And sometimes a bit like a mirror of what's actually happening when you're putting revealing dimensions of ourselves.
Right.
Because, for example, the Rupa, logically, I know it doesn't change. You know, the smile is not... It can't actually change, but actually, by looking at it and being with it, there seems to be this.
Yeah,
I think there's a resonance between the inside and the outside, isn't there? Because just, I mean, like if you look at that Buddha, you know, sometimes different bits would strike you, don't they? I mean, it might be the smile, it might be the role, it might, you know, just on a simple level like that. Your own associations are in your mind.
Yeah.
There is a meeting between the inside and the outside.
Yeah.
And open, it also comes back to your question. You know, it's like, it's not a fixed, this means that. It's open.
Mm-hmm. But the worry that I still want to come back to, if it comes from convention, once you stay away, if you open it too much, then you might stay away completely from convention and it becomes something else.
There's a difference between individual symbols and shared symbols, I think, isn't there? So sometimes something may have a really...
The quality of genesis is shared.
Yes. So that makes it a little bit difficult for it to adapt to your own needs in a way, doesn't it? But something else, it might be that a particular tree has a memory, a childhood memory, and that tree symbolises something just for you, but not for anybody else.
Mm-hmm.
So,
your personal
symbol, yeah.
Plus your cultural connection is really important, I think.
Yeah. It's part of your history and your background and your associations, isn't it?
Yeah, one person can look at an image or a symbol or hear whatever and have, a million different...
People have talked about this with the Buddha symbol, haven't they, the Buddha image, as to whether that is becoming a broken... symbol or a broken myth because it is so often used in advertisements and just in relatively frivolous ways. Yeah, that's right. I don't know. I wonder if people feel that it's true. For me, it's not had that effect, but of course, maybe it's, you know, it's got so ubiquitous recently that maybe now we just don't really see it as symbolising human enlightenment anymore. It's just a Buddha and it's vaguely attractive, I suppose, vaguely positive.
Well, I feel that it becomes effective if you see it as beautiful. And then it has spoken to you.
Yes.
I think for me it's a bit stronger because people do find it and abuse it a bit. So there's something about it just carries on being what it is, whatever you do.
Mm-hmm.
like, well, at home we have our shrine, but it's in our living room, and we might be reading or meditating or watching television or having an argument or making a mess or something like that. But the Buddha's just sitting on the shrine being the Buddha, whatever we're doing. Mm.
It's a bit like all these symbols in countries like Sri Lanka and Myanmar, where wherever you go, you get, you know, symbolic images, just in your everyday life.
There's definitely been a death of the toilet symbol for male and female, definitely in London. That's the death of the symbol, I think.
A sign, perhaps.
Yeah, there's only just abstract sort of, is that a man, is that a woman, or...
Sign.
it's a question about mythology. So mythology is symbolic.
Yes.
And... you were saying that a good way to express or communicate enlightenment is through symbology.
Yes.
So... would you say, because I think Joseph Campbell suggested that with the monomyth, there's only one myth in the world. He took all the, was a comparative religion. He took all the myths in the world and said there's one myth, the monomyth.
Mm.
He read a book on the Hero with a Thousand Faces, and George Lucas used it for Star Wars, for example. It's one story, and it's the journey to enlightenment. So he said it's the hero, sometimes male, sometimes female, who goes out of his reality and discovers a new reality. And over a period of time, gets an enlightenment and comes back to reality and gives that enlightenment to other people. So he was suggesting that all mythology is telling one story of enlightenment. So I guess that's kind of what you're saying.
Well, I'm not sure I am saying that, actually. I think, I don't know how I'd respond to that. I mean, I think some stories are better than others, though. And the Buddhist story, we have great teachings that go with the story. I mean, there may be some truth in that many of the great religious traditions have a single myth, but I think, you know, some of the stories are better than others, really. It's an interesting thought. I don't know what I'd say to that exactly. I do feel I'm scratching the surface a bit with this subject. It's a very, very deep subject.